viewpoints expressed on The Edge are not necessarily those of this radio station, its staff, management, or other sponsors.
It's time for The Edge Radio broadcast with your host, Daniel Lott. You can join Daniel and his guests as we discover the truth together. Within the continental U.S., call toll-free 1-800-996-9638. Or locally here in Indiana, 359-5593. That's toll-free 1-800-996-9638. Or locally at 359-5593. You can find out more about our guests and topics by logging on to The Edge's website, theedgeam.com. That's theedgeam.com. And now here's your host for The Edge Radio broadcast. Here's Daniel Lott.
Robert, you on the line?
I'm here.
All right, Colonel. Well, welcome to the Edge Radio broadcast. It's so nice to have you on this evening. And I was giving some of your bio earlier, and you have an outstanding record in the military and the things that you've done. But why don't you tell our listening audience a little bit about you before we get going?
Well, I don't know where to start. Go to my webpage at riflewarrior.com, and there's a bio there that's fairly extensive. But I started out, after I got out of high school, I went to the Marine Corps. And through some fault not my own, ended up in the infantry in the Marine Corps. And in 1965, was in the 9th Marines when we landed on the beach at Da Nang at the very first part of the war. And I spent a year there. I served as an automatic rifleman in a line company, and then later on did a little bit of work as a sniper. And was wounded in action and medevaced out in the summer of 1966. And in 1969, I joined the Tulsa Police Department and ended up working in most of the divisions within the department, from everything from patrol division to plainclothes, various and sundry different assignments, the bomb squad, SWAT team, which in those days we called the tactical squad. And then into finally aviation, and spent the last 14 years flying helicopters. Mm-hmm. As a sideline to that, I got back into the military, and after my 4 years in the Marine Corps, I ended up doing 26 years in the Army National Guard and later the Army Reserve, with the last about 12 years being assigned to an Air Force F-16 fighter unit, and I'm retiring as Lieutenant Colonel in 1999. During my police career, I also got into investigative journalism and writing books, and as you mentioned earlier, wrote or co-authored several books, both through mainstream publishers in New York City and through my own company that I started called Consolidated Press. Mm-hmm. And through Consolidated Press is where I ended up having to actually publish some books that my New York City author or publishers wouldn't handle, and that includes the Medusa File, which is a collection of cases that I've worked over the years as an investigative journalist, and Killzone, which was the book about the Kennedy assassination, JFK, The Dead Witnesses, and what happened to all the people that had connections to the Kennedy assassination that ended up dead, and a few other books. So, you know, like you say, been there, done that, and got a few T-shirts.
Well, when you say as a sniper, you did a little work in there, does that mean you did a little work like exercising extreme, what's that military term, extreme prejudiced?
Well, not actually. I wasn't in any black operations. I was in typical combat sniper where, you know, we went out the field spent 2 or 3 days out there with just myself and one or two other guys and tried to find as many of the VC or NVA that we could and kill them.
All right, and I suppose you did your work very well then, didn't you?
Well, let's just say there were times when we had a target-rich environment.
Target rich. Okay, that's an acronym for you got a lot of dudes over there. Well, Colonel, welcome to the show. And, you know, we were talking earlier this week. You said that you had personally investigated the Oklahoma City bombing, but yet your findings were rejected by was the FBI or the local police or who?
Well, basically, it was the FBI. What had happened in 1995, April of 1995, I was working in the helicopter unit at the time, but I had written several books, and two of those found their way into the local FBI office, and several of the agents had read them, and I'd had lunch with a couple of these guys before, and they said, "Where do you get all your information? Where do you come across all of these people?" I said, "Well, you know, when you work in intelligence in the military like I did, and when you do investigative journalism and you go places that, federal agents obviously either aren't going to go there or aren't going to be welcome there, then you make all kinds of contacts and develop a lot of sources." And I was used to dealing with sources earlier when I was working in plainclothes because we used a lot of confidential informants. So when the Oklahoma City bombing occurred, the local resident agent in charge of the FBI office here in Tulsa contacted me and asked if I would assist them in trying to investigate the bombing using any contacts that I might have, both in Oklahoma and nationwide. It was on day three at the time, and they had a guy named Timothy McVeigh in jail here in Perry, Oklahoma, and they had just transferred him to Tinker Air Force Base and were getting ready to move him over to El Reno Federal Penitentiary. And they said, "We don't know anything about this guy, and whatever you can find out about him, we'd like to know, and basically anything that you can dig up, because right now we're just starting with a clean slate on this case." And I said, "Well, you know, I'll do what I can, but I want you to be sure and, you know, call the chief up, and you tell him that you are making an official request for me, and then I want him to assign me to it, because that will cover me. In other words, I can't go lone rangering out here behind his back." And so they did that, which is probably the smartest thing I ever did, because that pretty much gave me official status and carte blanche to go wherever I needed to go. Well, over the next 6 months, what started out as an investigation turned into virtual circus. I saw so many times when witnesses were intimidated, statements had been changed, people that we should have picked up and talked to, they wouldn't even touch, they wouldn't even pick these guys up. We had evidence that was destroyed. The whole Murrah building was destroyed before it could be completely investigated. Then it was hauled off and it was buried. And then they put a fence around the site and put armed guards on, and they're still there today. You know, there's just so many things that happened to that case. And every time we developed good leads and we went back to the FBI with them, basically we found out that the FBI here, pretty much are guys trying to do a good job, but they're superseded by the people in Washington. And we have to remember that in those days, that was the Clinton administration with Louis Freeh and Janet Reno. And what started out to be an investigation turned into an absolute cover-up. And the real perpetrators behind McVeigh and Nichols were given a free pass on the deal and were allowed to disappear.
Mm-hmm. Well, how many...
We had so many eyewitnesses. Just like TW-800, you got 200 eyewitnesses that saw missiles. Mm-hmm. And you got the government that says, "No, you guys are all wrong." Oklahoma City, we've got witnesses that can place other people with McVeigh at different places, yet not one of these people, even after we identified them, not one of them has ever been picked up and questioned.
Really?
And when you work a case, you're supposed to, take every piece of evidence you can get, question everybody, work every detail, all the way down to the different dead ends and rabbit trails, which is what I did. The problem was the FBI wasn't allowed to. I'm talking about at the local level. Because what had happened was the same thing, and the reason that I saw this happening was because I'd written the book Killzone, A Sniper Looks at Dealey Plaza, about the Kennedy assassination. And when I was working on that case, what I saw was that local case had been taken away from the Dallas Police Department. The FBI under Hoover took it over, and the whole thing was spun to where when it ended up at the Warren Commission, they had all this paperwork that the FBI had done on this massive investigation, and none of it really said anything, because agents were sent hither and yon to talk to people who were totally irrelevant to the case just to develop paperwork, just to say, "My, look what a great investigation we did," when the actual perpetrators that were involved in this deal, walked on it.
Yeah.
Well, the same thing I was seeing happen in the Oklahoma City case. So I went to my contact agent, the guy that I was assigned to be my counterpart, And I said, look, I said, I got to ask you a question. We've developed all these leads. I've written all of these memos. I've written all of these reports. I've talked to all of these people. I've brought it to you. And I said, none of them have been talked to. None of them have been brought in. And I want to know something. Am I seeing November and December of 1963 happen all over again? He looked at me and said, what are you talking about? I said, because this is what they did on the Kennedy assassination. I said, and I explained what had happened, and I said, if you read my book, Killzone, you'll see exactly what happened. You guys are being sent hither and yon to interview Aunt Matilda and Joe Kent Peg, you know, Bobby Smith out here in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
Just to develop paperwork, just to say that we've done these interviews, just to show this big, massive pile of reports to say what a giant investigation you've done, when none of it amounts to a hill of beans or is connected to anything. Is that happening now? He just looked at me with kind of a wink and a nod, and yeah, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
And what they had done is they had brought in a totally separate team from the national level. Now, I think that it was probably the same bunch that came out of New York City that investigated TW-800 and the Amtrak derailment in Arizona.
Hmm.
Basically, their job is damage control.
Yeah.
And they came into Oklahoma City. They set up a command post there with a big black semi-truck with a fence around it. They took over everything, and the local agents in Oklahoma City and the local agents in Tulsa were used as an outer perimeter, so to speak. And they were sent to all these different places to do this alleged investigation, interviewing people of no significance, while the actual action that was taking place was happening inside this inner circle that didn't talk to anybody. They didn't talk to me. They didn't talk to local law enforcement. They talked to Washington, and they talked to the White House. That's the only people they talked to as far as getting their marching orders. Well, because of that, it didn't matter how much investigation we did. It doesn't matter who we came up with. If they didn't want to talk to them, they didn't get talked to. So a lot of the people that were involved in it that we know that we could take to court and say, this guy and this guy and this guy were there, and here's their pictures, and here's the witnesses that picked them out, and here's the videotape, and so on and so forth, they're gone. They just walked on the whole deal.
Mm-hmm.
We have their names. Jana Davis worked on this case with us, and she even wrote a book about it. And she went to senators and congressmen and the FBI and everybody else and tried to give it to them on a silver platter, saying, "Look, we have Iraqis here involved in this. We have these guys who we can name. We have hired private investigators. They followed them around. We've caught them, gambling in Las Vegas. We've caught them, at these meetings in Oklahoma City with these radical groups.
Mm-hmm.
We've caught them in Denver and Colorado Springs and Kansas City and so on and so forth. Fort Worth, and so we've traced stuff all the way to Boston. And we can link these guys together through phone records. We can do this and we can do that. And guess what? No one wants to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the bottom line is this. If you catch Jack the Ripper and you marched him up the steps of Scotland Yard, what are you going to do if they refuse to open the door? And that's basically where we're at with the Oklahoma City case.
You can't give it away. You had no criminals. You had no jail for the criminals.
Right. If the U.S. attorney isn't going to prosecute or even look at the case, what are you going to do with it?
Mm-hmm.
You're supposed to be the good guys, but you catch the wrestlers and you take them in. The sheriff says, no, I don't want to hear it. The jail's empty, but I don't want to hear about it. Don't even bother me.
Craig, that reminds me of the movie Tombstone, where in that movie with Kurt Russell, I think it was, there was a shooting in the middle of the street. And when they took him before Judge Spicer, they said, well, nobody's seen him shoot him, or they didn't have any eyewitnesses, so there couldn't be a murder. So he denied there was even a murder because there wasn't no witnesses, But let me ask you something on this TWA-800. Were there not actual film of a missile heading toward that plane?
Well, there were some photographs. I think somebody was shooting a videotape at a party on the beach, and they caught a blur that went by with a little stick on it, kind of like a missile.
Mm-hmm.
There were eyewitnesses and aircraft that were military, that they know what a SAM missile looks like. You had people at different places along the beach that all pointed the same direction, interlocking to where they said this thing came up, and they described perfectly a smoke trail of a missile that went up, changed direction, locked onto it, parked it, and then hit it. It was a clear night. Everything the government said about the TW-800 case was fabrication. They changed the weather. They changed the altitude of the aircraft. They changed the location. I mean, there's so many things that they changed that you could tell that there's a cover-up. Now, you can just for the listeners' benefit, The best time to get the best information is day one, hour one. If you see something on CNN or you see something on Fox or you see something, you know, in the news that pops up, if you've got a tape in and you're ready to hit the record button, you better get it right then.
Yeah.
Because I'll guarantee that if there's anything hinky about it, tomorrow the whole story's going to change.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to spin it. They're going to eyewash it. And so the TW800 deal, the best information came out right up front the night that it happened, because the next morning, what got my attention on the case, you know, anytime you get the government in an out-and-out lie, you know that they're covering up something. And the very first thing they did was lie. What they did is they had a full Navy captain with a receding hairline stand behind a podium and announce the Pentagon's take on TW-800. And basically what he said was that it was out of the range of a shoulder-fired missile because it was at, you know, 16,000 feet or whatever it was, and a couple other things, and automatically, I had already checked by that time on some contacts I had with the FAA, and I knew that, you know, what altitude it was, what heading it was on, the whole bit. But the main thing was, I knew that it was well inside the range of a Stinger missile.
Mm-hmm.
We also knew that, the Arab terrorists, if you want to call them that, the Middle Eastern terrorist, or Islamic terrorist groups, had access to all kinds of Stinger missiles.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I wrote a report, I sent it to Agent Kallstrom at the New York City office of the FBI, faxed it to him, and also sent an email, never heard a word back. But I basically said, you know, of course I didn't know who this guy was, I didn't know whose team he was on at the time.
Yeah.
And I said, look, I said, I work in intel with an F-16 fighter squadron. My main job is counterterrorism and base defense. My secondary job is I teach classes on things, and one of them is, you know, surface-to-air missiles and so on and how to avoid them. We know the TW-800 was well inside the envelope of a Stinger and the Russian equivalents. I said, we know, because it's only 16,500 feet.
Yeah.
We also know that they have them. The bad guys have them. And that they have a fatwa, and a fatwa is an irrevocable religious contract, a decision from the mullahs that something's going to be done, such as putting a contract on Salman Rushdie because he wrote the book Islamic Verses, or Satanic Verses.
Yes, right.
And the fatwa is once it's out there forever. Well, they put a fatwa on 10 American jumbo jets.
Yikes.
They wanted 10 for the price of one because of the shoot down of the AS-300 Airbus that the USS Vincennes did at the Persian Gulf, you know, a few years before. So because of that, they wanted 10 American jumbo jets blown up or shot down. They were willing to pay $1 million apiece for it, and they would provide whatever was necessary. Now, when you take that a step further, what do they have that they can provide besides explosives? Well, missiles. Where did they get them? They got them from us. How did they get them from us? They got them from the Mujahideen in Afghanistan after the Russians pulled out.
Mm-hmm.
Because we provided all kinds of Stinger missiles, and that's what one of the turning points of the Russian incursion into Afghanistan, is we provided them with all kinds of these Stinger missiles to shoot down MiGs and Hind helicopters. Well, those missiles ended up on the arms market, and a lot of them ended up into the Islamic terrorist underground, and had been used. They also had Russian ones that they'd captured, and they had actually used these and shot down some civilian airliners in Africa, and you can look this up on the internet, and see, you know, it happened in Rhodesia and South Africa and Zambia, or a couple of places over there.
Sure.
Okay, so now we know that they've got access to it. Did they bring them over here? Well, we had intelligence reports that said that they had smuggled them into Canada, and from there into where? The state of New York. This is, you know, 6-8 months before. After that, we lost track. Okay. So we put two and two together, and we have the World Trade Center bombing in 1993, in which we have this mosque in Brooklyn involved, and the terrorist cell that was working out of that mosque. And then Ramzi Yosef, of course, was tied in with this. Well, who else is Ramzi Yosef tied into? Ramzi Yosef was also tied into Operation Bojinka. Bojinka was the operation in the Philippines where they were going to do what? Blow up 10 American jumbo jets. And he was, you know, building the bombs to do this. Interestingly enough, while he was doing this in 1993, 1994, he had visitors, and one of the visitors was a guy named Terry Nichols. Terry Nichols went to the Philippines. He met with Ramzi Yosef. He met with a group called Abu Sayyaf, which is Ramzi Yosef was involved in, as was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Edwin Angeles, Muhammad Wali Khan, and a few others. And so, and by the way, Muhammad Wali Khan and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed worked directly for a guy named Osama bin Laden.
Hmm.
Now, interestingly enough, if you look at my book, The Medusa File, and go to the end notes, I think it's around end note 203 or 207, I name a guy named Osama bin Laden. This is before 1998. And Osama bin Laden's job, along with two other guys, was to blow up American jumbo jets. So now we have this thing kind of going full circle here. Now, what was Osama bin Laden doing at this time? Osama bin Laden, during the time of TW-800 and before, was working out of the Fort Sherman area of the Khyber Pass area of Afghanistan and Pakistan, right next to the arms markets. And he was running terrorist training camps. And he was financing Islamic terrorism in the Philippines and in Bosnia, and also in the United States. So when we start following the power, or we follow the money, or we follow the training, we get back to the same guys over and over again. Now, he has access in that area, because of Pakistan, where the arms bazaar markets are, to these Stinger missiles. And so here's Osama bin Laden, who's got these guys working for him, who are in the Philippines, training a guy named Terry Nichols to come home and be able to coordinate with other Islamic terrorists here to build a truck bomb.
Wow. Yeah.
And to also put explosives inside the building.
Mm-hmm.
That's where, you know, we don't have enough time tonight to go into all of that. But Terry Nichols pops up as the link between McVeigh and Oklahoma City and the Philippines, Abu Sayyaf, Osama bin Laden. We go the other direction with it, and we find that they're also linked to this bunch in Boston and in Brooklyn, who are tied into the TW-800 case. So now we've got 200 eyewitnesses plus that say they saw a missile hit the airplane. They think now that there was two missiles, because you got a lot of the witnesses say they saw one come from a certain area on land, and others say they saw one come off of the water. Did a missile hit the airplane? Absolutely. Did two missiles? Possibly. But one of the key things I say that I want to mention, and this is what I told you a little bit ago, that whatever happens, happens when it happens, because the next day they're going to spin it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I kept tapes and going all the time on this TW-800 deal on CNN. And they had one particular shot where they pulled one of the engines out of the water. Now, remember, by now the FAA is saying, or the NTSB and the FBI is saying, it was a center fuel tank explosion. You know, just decided to blow up that day. I guess it had a, you know, bad day. In actual fact, we know that one of the engines came apart and caused holes in the wing, holes in the center tank, and
yeah,
then there was a resultant explosion,
mm-hmm,
et cetera, et cetera. Well, they pulled this one engine out, and I believe it was number three engine, and when they lifted it out of the water to put it on a barge, all of a sudden, I look at this thing, and it's bent in the middle, and it looks like it was hit right in the side with a heat-seeking missile. With high explosive. It was burnt, it was bent, you could see where it had been hit. We never saw that tape again. We never saw that shot again. Now, remember, when they reassembled the wreckage in the Calverton hangar, they had all this wreckage sitting there on the scaffolds, but you didn't see the engines, did you?
No.
The engines were taken away.
Well, let me ask you something, Colonel Roberts. This isn't necessarily a show about UFOs, but I was thinking, because you were talking about how the information changes the very next day, which is exactly what Dave Von Cleese said in one of our shows, talking about 9/11, saying that when there's a major catastrophe of any kind, you get your tape machines rolling. But back in the Roswell era, was that the first time when the first day the military said there was bodies, there was a craft, they were taking it to Wright-Patterson Air Force, and like the next day, all of a sudden they said it was a weather balloon? Was that the first evidence of how the government will shift the story the second day or the third day? Hello?
Yeah.
Did you hear the question?
No, actually, I got disconnected.
Oh, well, you're back.
Yeah, I am now. I just found out what happened here.
That was crazy.
All right.
All right, well.
As soon as you said Roswell.
Oh, I see. Well, anyway, that looks like to me in history that seems to be the first evidence of changing the story the next day. But that is absolutely right, because on when the Oklahoma City bombing happened, I remember distinctly that day they were saying there was one bomb, two bombs, there may be three bombs, and then 2 days later it was just one bomb and that was it.
Well, you know, it actually started out that morning. I was sitting in a barber chair on my way to work, and they came on at 9 o'clock in the morning, and they showed the smoke cloud over Oklahoma City on the local news, and they said it was a natural gas explosion, and ambulances were headed that way, and fire trucks, and so on. The next thing, I get to work in my police car, and I get out of the car and walk inside, and they got the TV on in the pilot shack, and they're saying, well, it was a car bomb, and 30 minutes later, you know, we're starting to get some feedback through law enforcement now, and I'm just looking at it going, well, yeah, I wonder what this is all about. I'm not really keyed up on it yet. I haven't had my coffee yet, you know, and I'm looking at this going, And then they said, you know what, that's too much damage for a car bomb, so it must be a station wagon. Yeah, that's it. It's a station wagon. And then some guy in the bomb squad says, no, that's way too much damage for a station wagon. So they said, well, okay, how about a pickup truck? No, it's got to be bigger than that. So they just kept growing and growing and growing. They didn't know what they were doing. So finally they had a moving van. And I got a phone call a couple of days later, and one of my informants down there says, hey, did you know what it was? It was a UPS truck. And I said, UPS truck? Give me a break. They already said it was this Ryder truck, and they've already traced it to this, you know, outfit up in Kansas. He said, no. He said, they already know it was a UPS truck. And so I'm going, okay, here's another one, you know. We'll put this one on the wall and forget about it and see what happens later. Now, when I say that, what I'm talking about an intelligence game, what we do is we take all the information that we have on a given scenario and we put it on the wall, so to speak. And we've got bits and pieces of a puzzle, and when you get enough pieces up there, it forms some kind of a picture, and you can take some of them and throw them away, and some of them you're not going to have, you know, you're going to have gaps where you don't have that piece of information. But pretty much after a while, you can start to put the thing together. And so, okay, fine, we'll put the UPS truck over here on the wall, but we're going to forget about it until something else comes up. Well, about a year later, no, actually, I'm sorry, it was about 5 months later, we go to court in Tulsa, and they're doing some kind of a hearing with the three-judge panel on a lot of the evidence to be presented and so on and so forth. And a lot of people from Oklahoma City and some of the victims came up, and one of them brought this big poster. And on it was the Murrah Building. And right in front of the Murrah Building, right in front of the doors, was a UPS truck. And there was a time at the bottom, where this was taken off of a videotape, there was a time at the bottom, and it was like 8:58 a.m., 19 April. Well, you know, we know that the bomb went off, or the truck bomb went off at 9:03, and then there was another explosion right after that that went off about a minute and a half later. Or about a minute later. And we have those on seismic events, by the way. We have three distinct explosions on seismic events. So I'm looking at this, and I'm going, where'd this come from? And so I started, this came from one of the people that was a victim in the building, and what they had gotten hold of was a sheriff's office still photograph, several still photographs actually, from a videotape that a surveillance car had taken. Listen carefully. A surveillance car was sitting a block away in front of the Murrah Building, right across the street from the Journal Records Building, and was taking surveillance, videotape, and still photos of the front of the building when a UPS truck drove up. Now, when the UPS truck left, there were two guys in blue jogging suits, two Middle Eastern males, that came out and stood at the curb line and held the parking place for the Ryder truck, which McVeigh had parked and stopped at the curb line a block west, waiting for a parking place, because you don't just drive up with a big truck in front of a federal building in downtown Oklahoma City and expect to have a parking place. So he had to have two guys there ready to hold it as soon as they could, and he didn't come down until they signaled him to come down. So the UPS truck had been there, but it didn't carry the bomb. Okay, now let's back up. Remember what I said, surveillance tape from the sheriff's office car of the front of the building before the Ryder truck showed up. Now, why was that car there? Now, Charles Key lost his job in the State House of Representatives because they said he was a wacko because he was trying to prove that the government had foreknowledge that something was going to happen. His whole thing was, I just want to know, did the government have foreknowledge? And the government says, no, there's no way we would have known. We wouldn't have let those people die. We would have got them out of there, blah, blah, blah. Well, if they didn't have foreknowledge, why did they have the building staked out? And we had photographic evidence in court showing that they staked out the building in advance and no one did a thing about it.
Craig, was that part of the lawsuit that some of the family members filed against the Oklahoma, maybe the police or the government for that matter, right after that? Because they knew?
No, this wasn't part of that. This had to do with some evidentiary procedure and stuff.
Let me ask you again. You were talking about the truck. What about that picture that's been circulating on the Internet of the Ryder truck being in an Air Force base? Is that a hoax?
No, that was Kent Gruber. And that has nothing to do that I can determine the Oklahoma City bomb, because I know who took those pictures, and I know when they were taken, because I was the first one to see them when they came out of being developed. That it was a totally different scenario. What that was Kent Gruber is a National Guard training area that's open to the public. Anybody can drive through the gate and go deer hunting or whatever down there.
Mm-hmm.
DOD and DARPA had come in, and they had fenced off a little area in there. This was in November of 1994. This is, 4 or 5 months before the Murrah building. And they had a Ryder truck there, but they also had all kinds of other vehicles and some other equipment down there, but they were doing some kind of testing that was top secret. I don't know what it was they were doing, and looking at the photos, I still can't figure it out. But a friend of mine was flying out there in a Cessna, And he was looking, he was scouting deer is what he was doing, and taking pictures. And lo and behold, he came back with these pictures and wanted to know if I knew what they were, because I spent a lot of time down at Kent Gruber when I was in the National Guard. I knew every rock and tree down there, and I had never seen this before, so I was looking at it. And, of course, you got to remember that the military, then and now, leases a lot of Ryder trucks and other lease-type vehicles to haul stuff around in. So, there wasn't anything hugely unusual about that. But it didn't have anything to do with Oklahoma City, because it was gone months before Oklahoma City.
Okay.
And we made no connection. Interestingly enough, though, the coincidences around here is Kent Gruber isn't really too terribly far from Elohim City. Now, Elohim City's on the Arkansas border. It's probably 40 miles away. So if you draw a line from Oklahoma City due east, you hit Kent Gruber, and you go east of there, you hit Elohim City, and Elohim City, of course, is where Strassmeyer was, and Dennis Mahan, and Carol Howe, and all the rest of that bunch. And so, we had those guys to contend with as well, So, this thing was like a snowball. It just kept growing, and it kept growing, and when you work a case like this, you keep running into more people that are connected to more people.
Yeah.
You start drawing a flow chart. You draw an organizational chart, so to speak. Who did McVeigh know, and who did he hang out with, and where did he go, and who did he talk to? The same thing with Nichols. The same thing with these Iraqis that we know were involved.
Okay.
Same thing with Strassmeyer and so on down the line. Well, we did that, and we could fill up a whole wall with this organizational chart. And, I was talking to one of my FBI buddies, and he says, "What you got there?" I said, "Well, you would think it's an organizational chart, but it's done more on the lines of a big hairball. Everything just goes back and wraps up and connects to itself every place.
Mm-hmm.
It's a mess trying to figure out who knows who runs with who, and who's connected to who, because there's too many places here that are rabbit trails to go off and just hit a dead end. It was too well orchestrated and covered up in layers like an onion to be just Lee Harvey McVeigh and Terry Nichols,
Okay. All right, Colonel.
That's where we ended up with this thing, it's way above the pay grade of those two morons.
Okay, with that, we got to go to commercial break there, Craig, so just stay on the line, please.
We'll do it.
All right. Everybody, you're listening to The Edge radio broadcast. My name is Daniel Lott, and you can expect the best in guest every Saturday night on our Newsmaker line. We have Colonel Craig Roberts. We're talking about TWA, Flight 800, Waco, Oklahoma City. And if you'd like to see what other books Colonel Roberts has authored and co-authored, go to his website at riflewarrior.com. My name is Daniel Lott, and we'll be right back.
This is the place where you hear the big news of.
Would you believe it happened on
the LIG, South Vietnam? That's why our listeners say,
we'd rather fight than quit.
The oldie but goodie sound.
Radio LIG.
This is the radio vacation.
This is Radio IK, South Vietnam.
Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. It's the wonderful. Enlightening, entertaining, and controversial. This is the Edge Radio Program with your host, Daniel Ott.
And welcome back to the Edge Radio Broadcast. And don't forget, Wednesday night, our VoIP our business opportunity. So you need to tune in every Wednesday night at 8 to 9 p.m. And on our newsmaker line, we have with us Craig Roberts. Craig, welcome back.
Oh, glad to be here.
Well, it's so interesting to talk to you. When you're talking about conspiracies of the government knowing foreknowledge, and what you're really saying is there seems to be a pattern, and you're really more or less exposing that there's a pattern through history, and that we need to pay attention to events to see how the outcome is and how it's manipulated. But what's the end of that? Should we trust the government?
Well, you know, that's a great question. And the answer is never. And here's why. First, we have to define what is the government. Well, let's just define the government in the United States. What we have today isn't even a shadow of what was created in 1776 through 1778. What we have today is some kind of a giant Portuguese man-of-war. Now, if you know your biology, you know that a Portuguese man-of-war is a colony of several different animals under one umbrella. They all have different length stinging tentacles, and it floats around the ocean and pretty much does what it wants to do. But each animal, even though working together, is still independent and will still sting you. Our government is typically like that. It is a giant amoeba that can eat its young, and it's fueled by our money. And you have people who get inside of government who use positions of responsibility and authority and power for either their own benefit or the benefit of an agenda of some organization that they are a member of, whether it's the Council on Foreign Relations, whether it's the Royal Society for International Affairs in London, whether it's some other organization out here or some cell group in the CIA that smuggles drugs, whatever it is, you have people who will be in those positions of power in those areas accomplishing stuff that is for them or their agenda, but not for you and me. Mm-hmm. And the watchdogs that are supposed to make sure that doesn't happen no longer exist. The reason being is, if we had an FBI that was honest and independent and did what it was supposed to do, then you would have people in the White House, you would have people in Congress, you would have people in the bureaucracies that would be very afraid to break the law, because there would be somebody there to put the hand irons on them. That no longer exists, because when Hoover went away, and I'm not a Hoover fan, don't get me wrong, but mm-hmm. when Hoover went away, Nixon created a situation where Ford created a situation where the president would appoint the director of the FBI, the director of the CIA, and so on down the line. Because of that, they're all controlled by the White House. Now you've got an organization that can't investigate the White House because it's controlled by the White House, and it can't investigate the administration's buddies in Congress for the same reason. Because the boss would lose his job. So now there is no watchdog to look out for us and look out for what's right. It's all controlled. And because of that, we live in a situation where we've got all these government bureaucracies and agencies out here that pretty much do what they want to do, and we're not we the people anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, we go to school now, and we're taught that the federal government is this high government, you know, up at the top. And then it goes down to state government below that, and it goes down to county government below that, city government below that, and town below that, and so on down to the private individual. That is exactly wrong. That is exactly the opposite of the way it was set up in the Constitution. In the Constitution, we the people, you and I, were the government. We had a homeowners association set up in a place called Foggy Bottoms, Washington, District of Columbia, where we sent representatives to represent us, and we only did it for short periods of time because we didn't want anybody getting too much power over there, you know. And they were elected by us to represent us and to listen to us. The problem was government has grown so big for different reasons over the last 200-something years that now it's at the point to where they think they run the place and we're just a bunch of peasants out here. So it's actually turned the pyramid upside down.
Yeah.
Now, you know, there's a lot of people say, well, Robert, you know, you talk about the Constitution and this sort of thing, but, you know, what keeps the government in check? What, you know, isn't the government supposed to obey the Constitution? Yeah, it is, but they don't. What is the most important amendment to the Constitution? And people say, oh, it's the First Amendment. That's the freedom of speech and the freedom of religion and so on. I would say, no, it's the Second Amendment. That's the one that keeps us all free. Well, yeah, if you exercised it, it would, but we don't. It's the Tenth Amendment. And I work for a congressman part-time, John Sullivan out of Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I handle his Veterans Affairs stuff here in town. And I said, you know, John, when he went to Washington, I said, John, I said, this is the Constitution. I gave him a pocket Constitution. I said, I want you to read this. Before you ever go to Washington, you better know this thing, because I'm going to be asking you questions. And when we got all, you know, a few weeks later, I said, okay, now I just got one question to ask you, John. What's the most important amendment in the Constitution? He just kind of looked at me, and he started, you know, hem-hawing around. I said, John, it's the Tenth Amendment. Mm-hmm. Now, what does the Tenth Amendment say? And he kind of thought for a minute, and he started to reach and look it up. I said, if you got to look it up, you need to do more homework.
Mm-hmm,
the Tenth Amendment is the handcuffs. That's what tells the government what it can't do.
Right.
And basically it says, if it's not in this Constitution, you can't do it. It's reserved for the people or the states. And so you can't pass a law in violation of the Tenth Amendment. The Tenth Amendment says if it's not in the Constitution as a power, then you can't pass it. Yet they pass laws in violation of the Constitution every day.
No doubt about it.
And who fixes it? Who goes back in and says you can't do it? Nobody does.
Well, it's not the
case. So what we have is we have a government that's out of control. It does what it wants. It lies. It cheats. It steals. It kills. It does whatever it wants. You know, Oklahoma City, TW-800, you know, all the 9/11 stuff, everything else has happened. It's all happened without any checks and balances to go back and say, wait. Now, and people say, wait a minute, Robert, you're crazy. You're a conspiracy whacker. No, I don't deal in conspiracy. I deal in fact. I mean, I don't deal in theory. I deal in fact. And you've got to just look at what has happened in the last 15 to 20 years, just in the last 15 to 20 years in Washington alone. And you have these people say, well, you got these congressional investigations, and you have these special prosecutors, and they spend all this money, and they do all these investigations. Yeah, really? Tell me. What's the results of these investigations? I mean, the last time they had any investigation where there was a lot of smoke and flying was when Joe McCarthy was out chasing communists. Since then, they did away with the House Un-American Affairs and Activities Committee. All of a sudden, you know, everything kind of went south and went out the window. Yeah, they do investigations and they go away. Now, they did three investigations in 1995, or they were going to do three. They only did two. They were going to investigate Waco. They were going to investigate Ruby Ridge. And they were going to investigate what? MENA. They were going to investigate the Iran-Contra affair through basically MENA, except the problem was the Clintons were in Washington. And they had come from where? Arkansas. And he was governor of Arkansas during Iran-Contra. So we had the MENA investigation didn't occur, did it?
No.
Now, why? I'm not sure, but I'm going to give you my thought on it.
All right.
I received a phone call about a month into the investigation. Guy said that he was a federal agent, that he was in Little Rock, and that he wouldn't tell me which agency, and he wouldn't give me his name or anything. I knew it wasn't FBI, and I knew it wasn't CIA, so I kind of think it was IRS or DEA. But he said his agency had investigated drug smuggling and money laundering that had gone through MENA and through the Northwest Arkansas Mafia and all of that sort of thing. And that when the Clintons went to Washington, that they took all the investigatory records and hid them. They took them out of Arkansas and they hid them in the Murrah Building.
Really?
In Oklahoma City. Now, I thought, well, this is kind of interesting, but let me throw the second thing in there. On day one, by 10 o'clock in the morning, they said they found more explosives inside the building. They pulled everybody back, right?
Yeah.
And then they said, well, you know, it wasn't anything after all. But what did they do for the next 2 or 3 hours? They brought in a team of 50 guys with no letters on the back of their Blu-ray jackets. And they brought in 2 military box ambulances, and they went to the Murrah building when everybody else had been pulled way back, and they carried out boxes of files for almost 2 hours, searching that building. They had people inside the building trapped in rubble, and they abandoned those people. And the reason we know this happened, there was a fireman on the 6th floor who didn't get down and didn't leave the building, and he watched all this happen. He watched them carrying this stuff out on stretchers and putting them into the ambulance. I then interviewed another fireman who was there on day 10, and he said that when he was filming relief efforts around there for training films for their academy, that he had walked around with an FBI agent. They'd walked around behind the post office, which was a block to the west and a catty corner across the street. And the post office closed down, of course, because all the windows were blowing out and so on. They had it all boarded up. But they had a big white Ryder-type truck backed up to the shipping dock.
Oh, boy.
They had guys with machine guns standing around with black ski masks and black SWAT fatigues,
mm-hmm.
holding, you know, making sure nobody came near while they carried out boxes and boxes and boxes of what he said was files and put them on this. And he asked him, he said, this fireman said, what are they doing? What's that all about? And the FBI agent said, well, I guess it's undelivered mail. Well, since when did you need a 50-man SWAT team with MP5s for undelivered mail?
Yeah, that's weird.
So I think that the records were taken out and put in that building until they decided what they were going to do with them. Then they went to Never Never Land.
Yeah. All right,
because we did not have the MENA investigation that year.
Yeah.
It went away.
Yeah, it did.
No records, no evidence.
Yeah.
And, you know, here's another thing. If I'm wrong, if McVeigh and Nichols were in this and no one else, fine. I don't have a problem with that. I know it's not true. So, federal government, show us the videotapes. Show us how many people got out of the truck.
Mm. Okay.
The case is over.
All right.
The guy's dead, supposedly. Mm. Nichols is in jail. They're not doing anything with it. They don't want any more evidence. Show us the videotapes. We know they have at least 2 and probably 3 or more.
Okay. Hey, I got this might be a weird question. I don't think we've asked too many weird questions tonight. What about that extra leg they come up with in the rubble?
That was never explained. It was a combat boot with fatigue trousers, camouflage fatigue trousers, and a leg of what they think was a black or Hispanic female. And it was extra. It didn't belong to anybody around there. We received information about 3 or 4 months ago that somebody had seen one of the videotapes. And they said that you could see McVeigh getting out of the truck, another male getting out, and a female, which I thought was real interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the first time that we had heard anything else about a female being mixed up in this.
Mm. Here's a question we have from California, and I don't know what the acronym is here, can you explain the relationship of the ADL to the Oklahoma City bombing and why they were pointing investigators in the wrong direction?
Well, that's the Anti-Defamation League of the Benign Breath, and we asked ourselves that same question. What had happened was all of the eyewitnesses, all of the information we had on day 1, day 2, and day 3 had to do with Middle Eastern or Islamic males being involved in this. In fact, they even had one brought back from London to interrogate that had left in great haste from Oklahoma City that morning an hour after the bombing. We had eyewitnesses tying in all kinds of different Islamic and Middle Eastern males to this thing. We ended up finding out who they were. We found out where their money came from. We found out who they worked for, the whole bit. So we're following these leads, and all of a sudden Sunday, remember the bombing occurred on a Wednesday. On Sunday, they raid Nichols Brothers Farm in Michigan. And by Monday, there was this giant media blitz that went after the militia, the right wing, everybody to the right of Genghis Khan out here was suspect. And all of a sudden, the whole Middle Eastern section just disappeared off the radar screen. And the FBI, basically, the local FBI, was told when the Clintons and Janet Reno's and Louis Freeh stood up and said there is no Middle Eastern connection, then all of a sudden the FBI just stopped going there. It was like persona non grata. It was like this giant roadblock had been put up. And instead, they started running out here following rabbit trails of anybody that was right wing. I mean, they went after Rush Limbaugh, Pat Robertson, and and you know, militia groups, which I'll guarantee that Washington had never heard of a militia group prior to the 19th of April, because I was in Washington on the 5th of April testifying before Congress and telling them that the people across this country were you know, getting afraid of their own government, and they were buying guns and forming militias and all kinds of stuff, and they looked at me like I was crazy. That was on the 5th of April, so by the 20th of April or 22nd, 23rd of April, all of a sudden, the militias are the bad guys, like they knew about it all along. I sit here and I went, wow, this is incredible, honey. Where's this coming from? And none of it had any substance. None of it had any links to what actually went on at the scene here in the field on location. So I made some phone calls, and I found out through my media contacts in New York where they were getting this garbage from that they had launched off on, and they said, well, we're getting it from two places. One is the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, of the B'nai B'rith, and the other is the Southern Poverty Law Center, a guy named Morris Dees. And I thought, well, what do they know about it? They're out here. They don't know anything about this. They're ruining the investigation. They're derailing the whole thing. You know, we're the hounds, you know, hot on the trail of the foxes, and they're trying to make us run up and check for possums. This dog don't hunt. So I started wondering, you know, what interest do these two groups have in this to begin with, and who are they? Because I'd never heard of them. And, I mean, I'd heard of them, but I didn't know that much about them.
Yeah.
And because... Abraham Foxman at the Anti-Defamation League of the B'nai B'rith, the ADL, they're connected to Israel. They're connected to the Mossad. You would think that these guys would jump up and down and say, yeah, Arabs, Middle Easterners, that's right. We told you. You got to help us fight them. You know, we'll all work together and go after these guys because they're the same guys that are, you know, trying to like blow themselves up in Israel. But they didn't do that. Now, what's wrong with this picture? This is the very bandwagon they should have jumped on, but they didn't want to have anything to do with it. Instead, they wanted to direct everything away from that. Now, Morris Dees, same thing there. Well, we just found out in the last few months that Morris Dees, Southern Poverty Law Center, may have had advanced knowledge of the bombing. We found out that Andrea Strassmeyer was reporting to the Southern Poverty Law Center. And Andrew Strassmeyer was sitting there at LOM City. They had inside informants in there. This is starting to come out now through a lawsuit, several lawsuits actually, FOIA suits, that an attorney in Salt Lake City named Jesse Trinidou, who would be a good guy to have on your show, by the way,
really?
Has filed on the FBI concerning the murder of his brother, Kenneth Trinidou, who was killed in the Oklahoma City Prison Transfer Center a few months after the bombing. Because they thought he was linked to the Midwest bank robbers who were linked to McVeigh, and that's another long story. But the bottom line is because of his brother's death, and the government tried to cover it up and make it appear as a suicide, which it obviously wasn't, he's been filing these lawsuits and getting this information, and all of a sudden these memos pop up, and they're leading to very strange places, and one of them names the Southern Poverty Law Center, and Elohim City and Strassmeyer all being connected together. Well, this is before the bombing. Well, if this is true, this would explain why they would want to, you know, they would want to ruin the investigation so it didn't point to them and then be culpable of saying, yeah, we knew it was going to happen and we didn't say anything about it. Or we knew it was going to happen, we told the FBI, and they didn't do anything about it. So we think that may be where that's going to go eventually, and we'll just have to wait and see how it pans out.
Yeah.
That's still an ongoing investigation.
Okay. All right, Craig, now you may have answered this inadvertently, this question here from Fast Blast here. This question is from New Jersey. Why did they choose the Oklahoma City building rather than the White House or the Capitol?
Well, we got to remember who these people were working for. If the records... that's an excellent question. But let me refine it even a little bit better, because the question is, should have been, why not, if Timothy McVeigh blew this building up in retribution for Waco, then why didn't he go down and blow up the federal building at Waco? Why didn't he blow it up in New Orleans where the ATF came from that started the Waco debacle? Why didn't he do it in Dallas where the FBI came from that ended the FBI or the Waco debacle? So, you know, that's what he would have done. That's what you or I would have done, right?
Yeah,
but
same area.
Why Oklahoma City? Oklahoma City didn't have anything to do with anything. It didn't even have an FBI office in it. Well, we go back to the records. That's the only thing that makes sense. It was so important for them to get those boxes of records out of that building within 60 minutes of the blast that they left people under the rubble still alive and pulled all the rescuers back and wouldn't let them back till almost noon. Now, this... call from Little Rock where the guy says, hey, we sent all the records from the drug running through MENA when Clinton was governor. And if you look at Terry Reed's book about Clinton and all of that bunch involved in Iran-Contra with all of the money laundering and drug running that came through MENA, then it starts to make sense. Now, let me just jump back and rewind the tape a minute here, because there's so many things that went on at the same time. Because at this same time period, I got a call from another guy that I know who's a former Texas state police officer. And he said, hey, I just got some information from one of my informants down here that there's a guy named Juan Garcia Abrego, and he is a Mexican drug lord and financed part of the bombing. And I'm going, oh, my gosh, here we know. I'm chasing Arabs. And now we got the militias involved. Now we got LOMC involved, and you're trying to give me Mexican drug lords. You know, where does this come from? This wall chart of mine is growing, in mathematical proportions here. And he said, all I can tell you is my informant said that he had two bag men go to Oklahoma City to help finance the bombing, and that they were going to dress up as Arabs. Now, all of a sudden he had my attention, because we had a report early on of two Mexicans or Hispanic males show up at a hotel in Oklahoma City dressed as Arabs. And we laughed it off. We thought, yeah, sure, right, you know, and that's all we need now. Because you get a homicide and three guys want to come in and claim responsibility for it, just like in the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, fine, whatever. But now, all of a sudden, we've got this Juan Garcia Abrego. So I wrote a memo. I took it to the FBI. And I said, just check and see if this guy even exists. So I waited 3 or 4 days and called him back. And I said, did you check on that guy? And he said, oh, yeah, it's just hokum. That's the word they used. It's just hokum. No such guy. Yeah, we checked. There's nothing there. I said, okay, fine. Well, about 3 months later, I'm in Phoenix working on the Amtrak derailment case. And I came back into the motel room and clicked the TV on, and all of a sudden here's this newscast, and they're dragging a guy off an airplane with a jacket over his head, and he's in handcuffs in Houston, Texas, and his name is Juan Garcia Abrego, and they had just, and this is the FBI, has got this guy, and they've just extradited him out of Texas. So I flew home that weekend, and Monday I stopped at the post office to mail some things. And I look up, and here's a wanted poster for Juan Garcia Abrego on the wall, and he's on the FBI's 10 most wanted list, and had been there for over a year. So I took that wanted poster, and I went to the FBI office, and I said, you remember this memo I wrote, 4 months ago? Yeah. You remember this memo that I wrote, 2 months ago? Yeah. And you said there wasn't anything to it. Yeah, we checked out. There's nothing there. And I said, how come he's on your 10 most wanted list? You just took him off an airplane Friday in Houston, and he's a big Mexican drug lord involved with what? Iran-Contra. He was the ground transportation link of the cocaine coming out of Mexico, coming up through Texas, and then into Arkansas and other places. Now there were airplanes flying into MENA, but this guy was the ground transportation link, or one of the main ones. So he would be also have an interest in making sure that those records disappeared that were in the Murrah building. So he would pay to have that done, too. So now we got the Clintons in the White House, who they would have been investigated. We've got the cocaine end of this thing. We've got the records in the Murrah building. And everything's just starting to stack up and add up. And every time we try to crack this nut, we're told there's nothing to it, and we don't want to hear about it, and go away. So why the Murrah building? I think that's the answer right there.
Mm-hmm. All right, Colonel Roberts, we have this question from North Carolina, and it's kind of a two-part question. There are numerous reports on alternative media and radio programs warning of a nuclear terror drill in Charleston, South Carolina, scheduled for January 31st. And do you know about that? And can you talk about this, how that, I guess there's a four-star general named Kevin P. Burns that may have been fired trying to expose a plot similar to this drill being scheduled in Charleston. Do you know anything about that?
I don't know anything about the second half of it. The first half of it, FEMA and other emergency operations agencies are going to be doing this all across the country. They're gearing up for biological, chemical, and nuclear because they're pretty sure that something's going to happen. And I personally think that probably there are nuclear weapons inside the country and have been here for a long time, because we knew back in the early 80s that the Spetsnaz teams out of Russia had brought these little suitcase nukes into the country and had them stashed around the country, so in case World War III ever broke out, they could use them to disrupt communications and airports and major highways and rail lines and bridges and dams and so on. We did the same thing in Europe. We had our backpack nukes that if we had to to you know, beat feet across Germany and France to head for the English Channel, that we could blow up dams and bridges and major intersections and airports behind us with backpack nukes. They're called SADMs, subatomic demolition munitions, or special atomic demolition munitions, and mini nukes. Well, if you had 10 of those, or even 5 of them, then you could set one off a day across this country in a city. It doesn't have to be very big. You know, take 6 or 8 blocks out, and if it's a dirty bomb, you can't go there for years. Downtown Manhattan, Denver, Los Angeles, and you announce to the world, we're going to keep doing this until we get our way, whatever that is. You're going to have absolute panic in this country. So what you have to do is you have to train in advance. How do you contain this? How do you deal with, you know, traffic control, contamination, relocation of people who are injured, and so on down the line? And that's what they're basically doing. The problem is, they're trying to make it all hush-hush and secret, and it scares people instead of coming out and saying, hey, community, we're going to be doing this because we've got to do something. We are not going to be unprepared. So I think we need to be real careful when we evaluate what's going on. You know, Houston is doing the same thing, and so are a couple other cities. It's not just Charleston. So eventually, I think every major city is going to have these nuclear response drills and try to determine, and they call them tabletop exercises, too. I participated in some of them. It's not that big of a deal as far as what's going on. There's no conspiracy there. I just think we need a lot better PR and get the public to help participate in these things as well.
All right. Okay, we need to go to break again, so just stay with us on the line, please. Everybody, you're listening to the Edge radio broadcast, and we are talking with Colonel Craig Roberts, and we're talking about conspiracies of various kinds. If you have a question for the Colonel, go to the edgeam.com website, click on Fast Blast, it'll come right to the studio. My name is Danny Lott, and you can expect the best in guest every Saturday night, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and you know we're one of the great shows thanks of our listeners, and those audio archives are stored on our server for free for you. We'll be right back.
Ladies and gentlemen of the Edge radio broadcast audience, count yourself among the fortunate and the lucky. Never before has being in the right place at the right time ever been so true as it is right now. You know the Edge has empowered you with the truth each and every Saturday night. Now, the Edge and Lightyear Alliance will be offering you an opportunity to empower yourselves financially. If I'd found a new technology that was going to cause the greatest transfer of wealth ever to happen here in America and a way for you to cash in on it, would you want to know about it? Well, tune in to The Edge each and every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to find the answer to that question. Or if you can't wait until Wednesday, simply click on the Lightyear link on our website or go to lightyearnow.com. That's lightyearnow.com. Join the thousands of others across America in the hottest business opportunity ever. Remember, if you keep doing what you're doing, you'll keep getting what you're getting. This is Daniel Lott with The Edge Radio Broadcast. See you Wednesday night.
Reasonable people finally just have to come out of their shells and say, look, there's other stuff going on.
Naturally, the public is going to start asking questions. Why have we been taught these things so wrongly in all the schools?
We are going to be talking about Class 1 data. Class 1 data is physical evidence that people can look at for themselves. They can touch it. It's in a museum.
Just got to get the facts to the people. You know, who knows when and if the government's ever going to come forward.
Off the train to nowhere and get on board the Edge radio broadcast. I'm your host, Daniel Lott. Let's discover the truth together every Saturday night on this radio station. And welcome back to the Edge radio broadcast. And for you forum listeners, there was a question on the forum as to whether or not I would kick you off the forum if you didn't switch over to VoIP. That's kind of funny. No, I wouldn't kick you off if you didn't switch over to VoIP. Hey, on our newsmaker line, we have with us Colonel Craig Roberts. Colonel, welcome back to the show.
Here we are.
Hey, I got a question for you. What about Ron Brown's plane? Was he shot in the head and that plane took down?
From everything I've been able to determine, yeah. He was shot after it crashed. And the interesting thing about that crash was the flight attendant who was up and walking around for an hour before the first helicopter got there, up in the mountain where the airplane crashed, the 737. And when they picked her up in the helicopter, took her down to the airbase, and when she got there, she had bled to death because of a cut in the femoral artery.
Yeah.
I mean, she was up walking around for an hour and didn't bleed to death with a femoral artery cut, but
yeah,
she got on the helicopter, and 15, 20 minutes later, she was dead because of that cut that didn't occur until after she got on the helicopter. And no one seemed to pick up on that in the mainstream media, which doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. We've got this question come in for you, Craig. Are U.S. presidents only figureheads, and who's ultimately behind our presidents? And really, do our votes count at all?
You know, that's the same exact question I asked when I was working on the Kennedy assassination. Because if you go to my website at riflewarrior.com and scroll down to Kill Zone, A Sniper Looks at Dealey Plaza, that book is what I was working on. When I got to the point where I said, wait a minute, we got a problem with this case. And that is, if Lee Harvey Oswald shot Kennedy by himself, and Jack Ruby killed Oswald, died of cancer, case closed, then why are the records, over 2 million documents, sealed until the year 2029 on Oswald? I mean, if this guy was a nobody, how come all of those stuff, you know, what do they not want us to know? Then the second question was, who had the ability to keep those records sealed, no matter who was in power, no matter who the president was, whether it was Republican or Democrat, no matter, you know, was there an entity that could control keeping those records, locked up and sealed that had to be above the White House? Is there an entity above the White House? Is there an entity above Congress and the FBI and the CIA and whoever the president is? That's where I had to go with that investigation and do that. I ended up going back over 200 years and following power and money and agendas that all led the same direction. And I found out, yes, there is a power higher than the president that he answers to. And it is a small committee known as the Committee of 13. And they pretty much run everything. They run the Bilderbergers. They run the Trilateral Commission. They run the Council on Foreign Relations. They run the Royal Society for International Affairs, the RRIA, the Roundtable Group, the Committee of 300, all of these different organizations, including some of the areas inside the inner circle of Freemasonry and so on, all are controlled by the same small group of people. And how I found that out was, interestingly enough, my wife's cousin spent many, many years in the CIA, and one of the things that he stumbled into was this group, because he ended up having to guard some of the meeting places where they met.
Really?
And they've met all over the world at different places. And during the Cold War, he explained it to me like this. He said, if you had a situation where you had a guy in a country, let's say Algeria, and you had to get him out of there and move him to safe ground in Canada, and the only way you could do it was use the assets of a French aircraft, a French helicopter, to a Russian submarine, to a British warship, and then from a British warship to an American vessel, and from an American vessel into Canada. Could it be done? Yes, these guys could organize it, and it could be done in 10 minutes.
Really?
So basically, who ran the Kremlin? Who ran the White House? Same bunch.
Well, who elects these 13?
Nobody. It's not an electoral position. It's a combination of decisions that are made from extremely wealthy people and the royalty of Europe and of Asia.
Mm-hmm. Now, is that as far as it goes? Is there any group behind the 13, or are they
no,
it?
No, one guy, the 13th member.
Yeah.
And I'm going to say this, and everybody's going to go, oh, gee, he's really lost it. But I'm going to tell you who I think it is.
All right.
I think it's Satan.
Really?
I think that in the world, 27 years as a police officer, you come to the realization eventually that there are two dynamic forces in the world, good and evil. God's on the good side, Satan's on the bad side. And a lot of people fall one way or go the other. And I think that these people, there's a lot of them think they're doing the right thing. They think that there needs to be a global government. There needs to be a new world order. There needs to be someone that controls all of the countries and makes us all the same. It's socialism at the very refined level. And it's a very satanic thought because it takes away the individuality of every human on the planet. and makes us all worker bees. And one of the things that they say is there is no God. You know, it's pure communism at the same time. The communist mentality falls into the same boat. So that's my own personal idea. You know, the only thing I can figure out is the head bad guy is in charge of the bad guys.
Mm-hmm. So you believe in a literal person of Satan?
No, I think it's it's a supernatural presence that controls these guys.
Mm-hmm.
It controls their thought and so on. But they leave. Now, the way it was explained to me, there's 12 chairs at there. There's 13 chairs at the table, but there's only 12 people that sit there. They leave the one at the end of the table for Lucifer. They call
Whoa.
Him Lucifer.
Mm-hmm. Have you found any evidence in the military of black ops or any kind of operations trying to access this spiritual presence to gain, say, information on the enemy or plans of the enemy or anything like that?
Well, you know, there's several areas that you can get into. You get into the remote viewing projects of Grill Flame and Starburst? I can't remember the name of the other one that was out of Fort Meade. But you had Michael Aquino, who was, you know, a high priest of the Temple of Set, who was a lieutenant colonel in the Army Reserve, who was very actively involved in satanic and Luciferian activities. He was an offshoot of Anton LaVey's Church of Satan. And here he was wearing a uniform and writing articles at the for the military on mind war and psychological operations and stuff like that. And when you started reading the stuff that he wrote, and it all paralleled a lot of the things that the CIA had worked on in the MK Ultra projects, and also Jim Jones at Jonestown on his mind control projects on dealing with forming a cult and controlling everybody. A lot of your cult operations are basically mind control operations, and they're very Luciferian in the way they do these things. If you follow these things, it goes into areas of Satanism, Luciferianism, witchcraft, all kinds of stuff, deniability of God, deniability of the Bible, and it's humanism and secularism versus religion and so on. When you do that, you know, a human being is made up of a lot of things. One of the things we're made up of is a certain amount of spirituality. We have a spirit, we believe in things. And if we're susceptible, people will tell us what we need to believe in or not believe in, and a lot of people go along with that. That's a form of mind control. Your television is a form of mind control. I mean, there's people out here right now, they live right next door to you, that tell you if they didn't see it on TV, it didn't happen. If they did see it on TV, it's the gospel truth, because otherwise, why would these guys say it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Dan Rather and Peter Jennings and all that.
That
media is a form of mind control, because there's so many people that jump right on board that bandwagon.
Yeah.
Well, when this happens, we allow ourselves to be controlled by an outside entity instead of using our own common sense and our own education and our own experiences to control what we do. We let other people control us. Whether it's coercion, threat, or just mind control, it all leads the same direction. Well, that's what these people do. And the military knows that there's ways to win battles. There's ways to win wars. If you can defeat the enemy's will to fight, then you don't have to defeat him physically. If he'll lay down his arms, or if he'll join you, or if he'll go the other direction, or if he'll just quit fighting, and you can do that without firing a shot. You know, Sun Tzu said that the best wars are the ones you win without fighting. And that's where you get into black operations. Now, where does it cross the line? Well, we get into things where I've read, and I don't have a lot of knowledge of this area, where satanic ritual abuse, SRA, and MPD, multiple personality disorder, are used to try to influence people at a young age so that when they get older, they become the super warrior or the super spy or, the don't question authority, just go do it type soldier. And those things were tried. Sid Gottlieb tried some of that stuff back in the 60s and 70s with the MK Ultra program. Since then, I'm sure there's been offshoots of that that have gone on, because MKUltra is supposed to have gone away somewhere around 1973, 75, right in there. But before MKUltra, it was called other things, and afterwards, I'm sure it's got different code names, but it's not something, it's not a project that's going to go away. It's just going to, you know, get hidden in a closet someplace and have another code name and so on.
Yeah. Colonel, you obviously been in the military. You took and swore an allegiance to the United States and defend the United States. Do you feel like what you're doing now with the books that you write and your website, riflewarrior.com, do you feel like you're doing your patriotic duty to expose these forces? To make America a better place? Is there any way to fight these forces, or what's your recommendation?
You know, that's a question I get all the time, because it's usually the question is it too late? And the other question is, what can I do about it, being you, as an individual? I think that I went through cancer in 1997, and I died on the operating table. I went beyond death experience. And I know that God exists. I know that there's heaven and hell. I know that we answer for the things we do. You know, I went through a year in Vietnam. I was wounded over there. I went through 27 years as a police officer, 14 years flying helicopters. I crashed in 3 helicopters and 2 airplanes, and managed to not get killed in those things. And, you know, so I've kind of been there and done that. And I just know that what my grandfather told me years ago when I was a young Marine getting ready to go to Vietnam was the truth, and that's basically this. He said, "Son, you all getting ready to go to that Vietnam place?" And I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Well, them Vietnam boys are going to be trying to kill you." And I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Well, you don't have to worry none." And I said, "I don't." And he said, "Nah." He said, "Good Lord calls you home, and you can't stop it, and if he ain't ready, no one can rush it."
Whoa.
And so I've kind of lived my life that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that when it's my time, there's nothing, you know, it's going to be that way. And until then, the one thing you do not want to do in this life is live in fear. So because of that, you know, I think that exposing the truth and keeping it out there where everybody can see and shining the light in the corners is a mission that I have to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been doing it on the radio. I've been doing it on television. I've been doing it in my books and magazine articles and columns and on the Internet and so on for years. And you know what? I've been threatened. I've been followed. My phones have been tapped. I've had my faxes tapped, my mail open, and so on. Dead animals on the front porch and all that, but I don't care.
Really?
And the bottom line is, I'm still here. And mm-hmm. I'm still talking about it. And I'll tell you something else. When I was working on the book, JFK, The Dead Witnesses, I tried to find all of these different people who had something to do with the Kennedy assassination as far as being a witness. And there was 115 of them that were dead. Now, this is, 15 years ago. And I started studying all of these people, and come to find out, the ones that were dead, that had been murdered, had had strange suicides, who had disappeared and so on, were the ones who were scheduled to talk to one of the 3 investigatory committees, the Warren Commission or the Senate Committee or the other one, Church Committee, and didn't get a chance to testify. They had remained silent up to this point, and they were killed before they were allowed to testify. Mm-hmm. All of the people who testified are still alive, or they died of old age later on, but they weren't mysteriously whacked before they could testify. So I think the best insurance is write about it, talk about it, and be as high profile as possible.
Yeah, and I would say this is one of those high profile broadcasts too. By the way,
well, and you're doing exactly the right thing. Because, the only thing they can do is, they call it the 4 Ds. Debunk, disqualify, destroy, or discredit. Okay? So if they can't debunk you, destroy you, or disqualify you, then they discredit you. I always throw an I on the end called ignore. If you don't hear anything, they just totally ignore you. They assume that, you're just gonna, dig your own hole. But if they can't do one of those 4 Ds, then you're good to go. Even if they do, that's good. You get somebody sooner or later that's going to jump up and down and scream and yell. That's fine. Hey, let's do battle. Let's jump up and down ourselves. Let's see where this thing's going to go. Well, they don't want that, because that's just that much more advertising. So the best thing to do, just tell the truth and go on down the road.
Mm-hmm. By the way, we have a comment from one of our listeners who says to you that you, in fact, are not crazy, that they believe as well that Satan is really behind the evil conspirators of this planet. Colonel Roberts, do you think that people in general, every once in a while you hear, because you mentioned it even earlier in the first hour, I think, of maybe a coming event. We were talking about this possibly suitcase nukes already being here. Should in any way our listeners or and the people you speak with and your other programs you go on, do you ever recommend that they prepare in any way, say, for physical needs during that time?
I think right now, if you got ready for Y2K, you probably did the right thing. You might have been a little early. I think right now everybody should be preparing. We've seen these things happen. We've got the bird flu that they're talking about. We've got nuclear that they said it's not if but when. We've got chemical. We've got biological weapons that have been developed. And by the way, they just finally, in case you haven't heard, they finally determined as of yesterday that the weapons of mass destruction, which is mainly biological, that was in Iraq, was shifted over to Syria, and from there disappeared into the hands of the Islamic terrorist underground.
Oh, boy.
So, yeah, you had them. Yeah, they're out someplace. And with our wide-open southwestern border, anything could have come across by now. I think that everybody should get ready right now with ways to filter water, ways to gather and store water, types of long storage food, whether it's dehydrated or you know, canned goods aren't that good for you, but get whatever you can get. But your different dehydrated foods, be able to grow your own foods if you can. If you live in the cities, then you better stockpile some stuff. There's a lot of places out here you can get these things. If you know any friends that are Mormons, LDS people, they know how to do this. Ask them. They've been doing it for years. I think it's extremely important that everybody's armed and knows how to use their weapons to protect your family and your neighbors and friends. And I think you need to communicate with your neighbors and friends and family and try to organize a little bit, set up ways to communicate. If the communications break down, the phones go dead, how are you going to talk to the guy down the street or across town? Watch the news. See what goes on. If you have an outbreak where they start quarantining different parts of the country, figure out what it is that the outbreak is and deal with it. Now, myself, I will not take inoculations, and I don't want anybody in my family to, because I don't trust them, but I will stock up on antibiotics. I will have other ways to deal with disease, sickness, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
There's all kinds of things you can do, all kinds of common sense. Now's the time to get your medical supplies, your Band-Aids, you know, beans, bullets, bandages, and Bibles, not necessarily in that order, so to speak. Yes, prepare, because something's going to happen. And I'll tell you right now, there's people in the highest levels of government who are preparing very seriously right now. And I don't think you're going to hear too much about it until they've already got what they need.
Yeah, their underground bunkers are already being stocked.
Oh, they have got more and bigger underground bunkers than you can possibly imagine.
Hmm. Well, let me ask you this. There's sort of a continuing debate that I hear out there as to whether, and you mentioned it actually too, about whether or not your time has come, whether or not the Vietnamese would pick you off. But could that not also be applied to this? I mean, say if somebody sets off a nuke here in Indianapolis, if my time's not now, would I be killed even though I didn't stock up or build a bomb shelter?
Well, you know, I think that we had the old saying in the military when, you know, we were training for this stuff. They said, well, okay, you can prepare for biological, and you can even prepare for chemical with gas masks and suits and all this kind of stuff. But what are you going to do if they nuke you in your neighborhood? Well, guess what? You're not going to do anything. You're going to die. That's just the way it's going to be. But that's not—it's not like the Russians with multi-megaton nukes. We're talking about small explosives here that contaminate small areas. The terror factor is more than the actual physical damage of these things. They're not very big. They don't do that much.
Yeah.
You know, when you talk about how much TNT it's like, if you've ever seen it, I watched a videotape of an explosion. It was done in Somalia when they blew up an entire ammo dump. They stacked it up for 4 days. They stacked explosives and set it off,
uh-huh.
And it looked like a small mushroom cloud, and it shook the ground a mile away. And that's it. You know, it's not that huge of a deal. Everybody thinks nuke, you're going to see, Hiroshima all over again, and it's really not that way with these small nukes that they've got. And yes, they do have small plutonium bombs that are terrific. They're tremendous, but these guys don't have them. I mean, they're in the system, but the bad guys don't have them. So we don't have to worry about that.
Mm-hmm.
But to get back to your question, if it's your time, I can't vouch for, you know, what's going to happen there. That's my own personal thought, that if God calls you home, you're going. And if he's not going to call you home, you're going to be around.
Yeah.
But does that mean we're not supposed to do anything? No. I think it's like Travis at the Alamo. You draw your line in the sand, and you say, this is what I'm going to do, and you do it.
Okay. Well, that's a good round way of putting that there. Now, Craig, let's talk a little bit about your website and your books again, if you like, on the riflewarrior.com. What do people find out if they go there?
Well, I've got all kinds of stuff there. If you go to Rifle Warrior, that's all one word. Rifle is in gun, warrior is in soldier.com. You can scroll down. You can read about different things I've done. You know, my passions and past experience when I was in Vietnam. A lot of photographs, things like that. The different things that I do, from scuba diving to sailing to just on and on. But you go on beyond that, go on down, you'll see a lot of the different books I've written, plus not only being able to order them there, but you can also, I've got e-books that I've placed there that you can get in electronic format. You know, you can get it with PayPal, and you get it emailed right to you, and you can open it up, print it out, do whatever you want to do in PDF format, which is your Adobe Reader format, which is available for free on the Internet. And you go beyond that, and you look down, and you'll see all kinds of articles that I've written, columns that I've done, and one of them you really find interesting is called The Baker Street Irregulars. It's a link, and you click on that, and it'll take you to a page with some of the case files that I've worked, plus some of the chapters out of the book, The Medusa File. And I would highly suggest that I've got the Oklahoma City report in there, by the way, but if you go to one of them, it's called the derailment of the case of the Sunset Limited. It's about the Amtrak derailment in Hyder, Arizona, which everybody's pretty much forgot about. But if you read that case, it's one of the most interesting cases I've ever written, or I've ever worked and then written about, and you'll be able to see who was really behind it. Mm-hmm. And what really happened, and when we brought this to the notice of the Sheriff's Department in Maricopa County and showed them all the information we had as to who was involved in this thing, all of a sudden the whole case went away. The federal government pulled up stakes and moved out, and you never heard another word about that case. So that's the case of the Sunset Limited at riflewarrior.com. Go down to the Baker Street Irregulars and click over there. Then down at the bottom of the page, you'll see all kinds of links to some of my friends and other typical nut cases.
Yeah. I've got a few more quick questions for you. You don't have to go into great detail on them, but how about this one here? Have you heard of, and this I know comes from the Internet, and I think we even had a guest mention it, is there any evidence of guillotines or concentration camps in America?
You know, I one of the guys that was working the Oklahoma City bombing case with me, David Hoffman, he asked me the same question. I said, and he was the former editor of the Hyde-Ashbury Free Press. He was my left-wing buddy. And I said, David, I said, why don't you start chasing those down? Find out where these camps are and go look them up. And you know what? The only ones that we found, they were photographs taken by people who'd never been in the military, mm-hmm. who didn't know anything about the military, and they were at National Guard training bases, open to the public, and it was fenced enclosures with a few guard towers and no facilities to speak of that were used as MP training areas for handling prisoners of war, mm-hmm. which is, you know, no big deal. When we really tried to find, are there concentration camps? No. What there is FEMA has bought a lot of... purchased a lot of real estate and had infrastructure put in for relocation of elements of the population. I don't know how big these places are, but we're talking hundreds of acres, in case they have to move trailers and tents in and so on. And I would imagine they'd probably fence these dudes in very easily if they wanted to. There are detention centers, and that is in Eglin Air Force Base and at Fort Chaffee, and there's another one in Pennsylvania up around Carlisle Barracks, where they brought the Cubans, you know, in the Mariel boat lift, and when they brought the Vietnamese over here, and Fort Chaffee, they turned the main part of Fort Chaffee into a prison, a virtual prison with fences and guards and everything, within 72 hours of getting the marching orders to do so, mm-hmm. with an engineer battalion going in there and setting up a chain link fence, the razor wire, the gates, the towers, the whole bit. And all of these military bases have the capability of doing that. So why go out here in the middle of nowhere and build some kind of secret concentration camp when we've got military bases with barracks and infrastructure already there?
Okay.
So that kind of goes in answer. I was doing a lecture in Denver, and a lady came up and she said, "Did you hear about the two divisions of Russian soldiers that are in the hidden in the Rocky Mountains up in?" And she told me where it was, and I looked at the map and I said, "Well, there's no roads there. It's wintertime. Yeah, the elevation's over 10,000 feet. These guys are freezing to death, and guess what? Where are they getting their toilet paper?" She looked at me and said, "What?" And I says, "When you start thinking of massive amounts of troops, that we hear all these rumors of all these, you know, thousands of UN troops hidden in the woods here and there, where's the logistics? You got to feed them. You got medical care. You got people that, you know, you got all kinds of stuff that's going to happen. If you don't have a logistical train, they aren't there. This is all internet rumors. So you have to be real careful when you go with that stuff. Now, the guillotines, that's a great one because we started really, it was kind of a chuckle, but the railroad cars with the shackles that were built in, I think it was Washington State or Portland or someplace by some railroad car company and so on and so forth. Tried to chase those rumors down to prove them one way or the other, and you couldn't find anything. Mm-hmm. There was just no substance to it.
Okay.
Those have been around for years and years. Some of those rumors go all the way back to before World War II.
Really?
And my question is, why would you want to use guillotines when you've got, you know, poison gas and you've got biological? If you want to reduce the population, you do it with sickness.
Uh-huh.
If you want to be the rider of the pale horse, you do it with germs. Even chemical weapons are no threat. Chemical weapon like the sarin gas in the Tokyo subway, how many people that hurt? You know, I mean, for the effort, it was worthless. If you're going to try to reduce the population, you're going to spray a city with an airplane at nighttime, putting biologicals down, and you and I are going to become the vectors. We're the ones that's going to transmit the sicknesses and the diseases back and forth, and we're going to kill each other off. That's what I have a fear of.
Mm-hmm.
I have a fear of Fort Detrick or Plum Island or someplace in Russia having some type of a biological that has gotten out.
Uh-huh.
And gets into the population, whether accidentally or on purpose.
Yeah.
And then being vectored in airplanes, going from city to city, and on buses and schools, and you know, down at the job site.
Okay.
I think is going to be the big threat.
All right.
I think we really need to worry about building our immune systems up and getting ways to fight biological infections.
All right. We have a few more questions. We might be able to get them in before the 10 o'clock hour here in Indianapolis. And now, don't hang up on me. We'll just go to the next question. But I got to ask it. It's just come in. Are you in contact with Dr. Stephen Greer, and have you ever heard of the Disclosure Project?
No.
Okay.
And let me ask you a question. What is the story behind the Amtrak railyard in Indianapolis that supposedly 10 years ago was a huge prisoner execution center?
Well, the story is, and I live here and I've seen it, what it was is they did a remodeling and they put up this high barbed wire fence, and they had the barbed wire pointing in as if to keep people in, not keep people out. And then they painted these red and blue lines, and I saw them, and they were right into these big warehouse things where they had put these sort of giant ventilation things. So I think what people got the idea was, and I think there was somebody, a lawyer here named Thompson, I can't remember her name, but she investigated.
Linda
Thompson, yeah. And well, so you had the red and the blue line, and you had these barbed wire fence facing in as if to keep people in. Of course, you had your train cars right there, and so people got the idea that they were building a depot for when people gather up, like they did in the Nazi time when they actually had red and blue lines, and depending on where they're going to gas you or what they're going to do with you, you either go red or blue. And so immediately people said, well, here it is. What we've said is coming true. It's right here in Indianapolis.
But it turned out not to be anything.
It turned out not to be anything. And I think Al Cuppett actually came down here, took a look around, and took a tour. I'm not sure. I thought he said that on the show here before. So, yeah, we've got a few things, and I've kind of scoped that area out to see if there's any shenanigans going on. You know, anytime you've got a train yard like that, it's a huge facility. It's kind of old, though, you know, in sort of a bad neighborhood. So I don't know if that qualifies for rounding people up or not. But we got this other question for you. Hey, I like your questions. Maybe I sit here and answer some questions. That's great. Do you believe the government is involved in any sort of weather manipulation? Did they have anything to do with Katrina?
Well, I don't know about Katrina, but the scientific community in this country has been interested in weather manipulation for years and years and years, all the way back to cloud seeding. But you know, you've got the HAARP project going on. You've got all these chemtrails that are they're actually using aluminum and different chemicals in that they still cannot explain, and even my contacts can't get to the bottom of it. Other than the fact that we know that Evergreen Air has some of the airplanes, and Evergreen Air does a lot of government black operations. They're out of Marana, Arizona. We've got all kinds of atmospheric heating projects going on that have been going on for years to try to figure out how to deal with the weather. The Russians have done more than we have. The Russians, with their woodpecker projects and some of the others, have been into this for years, and they wanted to develop weather weapons. Yeah, I mean, if you can dry a country up where they don't have any water, or you can flood it, you know, you don't have to fire a shot. You can create enough havoc that way. So, yes, I really think, well, I know that they've been interested in doing weather modification programs.
Okay. And we'll just get this one last question in here. This person says, we've mentioned the Islamic terrorists and 9/11 and that. Do you believe it was Islamic terrorists, or was our government involved with 9/11?
Well, the problem with 9/11, and that's not my area of expertise because I got a really full plate with Oklahoma City, mm-hmm. but from what I've seen and some of the people that I've talked to about that are up in that part of the country, there's no way that those buildings would have come down the way they did just because they were hit with a couple of airplanes. And what is it? Tower 7 was the third one that went down, and it wasn't hit by anything.
Right, yeah. Building 7.
And the way these buildings came down, they didn't come down like steel structures in a fire that in the manner that they should have. Instead, it looked like there were sharp charges in the building that imploded them from top to bottom, and it just went off bang, 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 bang as the things collapsed down. I don't think that the engineering studies that they did on television afterwards, where they said it melted through these big steel beams and all that with just jet fuel, have any relevance at all. Mm-hmm. I think there's a whole lot more involved in this, especially the fire department people who said that these guys had radioed out that they heard explosions below them. And so on down the line.
Mm-hmm. Well, Craig, I tell you what, we're here at the end of our broadcast, and it's been a real pleasure. Go ahead and give the name of the website of yours again.
It's riflewarrior.com, and the book you want to read is The Medusa File, Crimes and Cover-Ups of the U.S. Government. It starts in World War II and goes all the way up through TWA 800.
All right. Well, Craig, thanks for coming on the show. Can we have you on again sometime?
We'll do it again sometime.
All right. Appreciate you.
All right.
Good evening.
I have a letter here. Written a long time ago to a Mrs. Bixby in Boston. So bear with me. Dear Madam, I have been shown in the files of the War Department a statement of the Adjutant General of Massachusetts that you are the mother of five sons who have died gloriously on the field of battle. I feel how weak and fruitless must be any words of mine that would attempt to beguile you from the grief of a loss so overwhelming. But I cannot refrain from tendering to you the consolation that may be found in the thanks of the Republic they died to save. I pray that our Heavenly Father may assuage the anguish of your bereavement and leave you only the cherished memory of the loved lost. The solemn pride that must be yours to have laid so costly a sacrifice upon the altar of freedom. Yours very sincerely and respectfully, Abraham Lincoln. The boy's alive. We are going to send somebody to find him. And we are going to get him to hell out of there.
Yes, sir.
Have been listening to The Edge with Daniel Ott. To subscribe to The Edge newsletter, log on to TheEdgeAM.com. That's TheEdgeAM.com, where you can find out more about the guests and topics discussed on the air. The Edge is being brought to you by Internet Solutions, home of affordable website design and low-cost Internet access. Visit Internet Solutions at ES4.com. That's ES4.com. Until next week, for the Edge Radio broadcast, I'm Chris Moore. See you on the Edge.
News on the USA Radio Network is next. This is AM 1590, WNTS, Beech Grove, Indianapolis.